Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. The UN's annual climate summit gets underway in Azerbaijan on Monday, with 2024 on track to be the warmest on record. More than 100 heads of state and government are gathering in Baku for what's known as COP29. They'd previously pledged to stop the planet from heating by 1.5 Celsius by the end of the century, but it's looking likely to be roughly double that. And if the numbers don't convince the sceptics, maybe the climate will, with an increasing number of extreme weather events caused by man-made global warming. Europe, Asia and Africa have been affected by killer storms, heat waves and floods. Some examples: more than 220 people were killed last month in the Spanish region of Valencia in one of the worst floods in Europe this century. The BBC's Nikki Schiller described the scenes.
In front of me are dozens and dozens, probably hundreds of cars, all tossed in the air and in the middle of the street. There is debris everywhere. There are blocks of concrete that have been thrown around. There are bits of trees and the mud. It is thick, it is dirty, and it is smelly. And it has inundated the people's houses in the street.
Well, that was Spain, and firefighters in Southern California this month battled wildfires as the US state suffered what has been described as a particularly dangerous weather event. The local fire chief, Dustin Gardner, gave this update at a news conference.
We've got sustained winds more than 50 miles an hour with gusts over 80. Every firefighter in the region, all of our partners from Los Angeles City, Los Angeles County, Orange County, Kern County, Santa Barbara County, our partners at CAL FIRE, our partners in the sheriff, every law enforcement agency available, every helicopter, every fixed-wing aircraft, everything we've been able to get a hold of is here fighting this fire, and it is moving at a dangerous rate of spread. Bushes are burning, grass is burning, hedgerows are burning, agricultural fields are burning, and structures are burning. These aren't one of those fires where you can wait and predict and maybe stay home. Your homes can be replaced. Your lives can't. Leave.
Wildfires in Southern California, and back in May, a devastating landslide on a mountainside in Papua New Guinea after weeks of heavy rain killed hundreds, perhaps thousands of people. We heard then from Mate Bagosi, the UN's humanitarian advisor in Papua New Guinea, who'd visited the scene.
We found a scene of complete desolation, I must say. Populations affected are understandably traumatized. The landslide is very, very deep, has covered 6 to 8 meters of depth almost everywhere, which makes rescue efforts very challenging. In addition to this, the landslide is still moving slowly, which makes rescue very dangerous.
That was the picture in Papua New Guinea back in May. Some examples, a few examples of the extreme weather events there have been in 2024. Let's speak to Adil Najam, Professor of Earth and Environment at Boston University. He's on his way to COP29 in Baku and joins me now from Islamabad in Pakistan. So what are they going to be discussing at COP29?
Thank you, Julian. They're going to be discussing a lot of things. And for some of us, the fear might be that we'll be discussing so many things that, like the previous 29 COPs, we will end up with a lot of talk and very little action. But the biggest thing on the agenda, at least for this COP, is what's called climate financing, which is how do we fund, particularly in the poorest, most vulnerable countries that are at the front end of the impacts but haven't been the major causes, how will we fund the actions that are needed? And now, because we are so late in doing this, how will we fund the damages and the loss that is happening, right? So 10 years ago, the funding question was, how do we fund things so that this doesn't happen? Now that climate change is happening, as your report just pointed out, in every continent of the earth, right? You gave us three examples from three continents, but it's every continent. How do we fund the action that is needed? It's very urgent, but I do not think the COPs have a very good track record of doing what they are supposed to be doing.
Will the summit end with any kind of commitment on the reduction of emissions?
That is not on the agenda per se. right? And frankly, if you think about what has happened to the commitments that we've made before, for example, in Kyoto, for example, in Paris, you just pointed out very rightly, there is no science I know which tells me that we are going to meet the commitment of 1.5. Right. So in a way, that's my worry is not that it won't have a commitment. My worry is that on the things we have committed already, will there be action or not? So in some ways, I think this game of making future promises, which is what we did at Paris, which is what we did at Kyoto, which is what we try to do at Copenhagen, people have perfected it because future promises are far cheaper and far easier than doing action today.
A forthcoming change in the United States in the administration, is that something that is concerning those gathering in Azerbaijan?
Oh, it's clearly concerning a lot of people. And if you hear the chatter, or not just on media, social media, people who are going there, that's very much top of the mind because it is such current news. But again, I come back to this urgency question. It is not as if when we didn't have this change, right? When last year, for example, in Dubai, or the year before that in Egypt, or the year before that in Glasgow, when we didn't have this change happening, it is not as if we did a lot of stuff and now we won't be able to. It is much more than that, having not done what we are supposed to do. By we, I mean particularly the high-emitting richer countries that are the primary cause of this. Having that track record, is this going to make it even more difficult? But to me, I think we should look at the process and we should look at what the process can give, but have this laser focus on action today rather than promises tomorrow.
Professor, many thanks. That was Adil Najam, Professor of Earth and Environment at Boston University, who is on his way to COP29 in Baku. And as we've just heard, overshadowing this UN climate summit are the prospective energy policies of the incoming US administration, led by a man who's described climate change as a hoax. During his last presidency, Donald Trump pulled the US out of the Paris Climate Agreement, which sets legally binding targets for CO2 emissions, and is reported to be preparing to do so again after President Biden rejoined. And then there's Mr. Trump's refrain of drill, baby, drill during the campaign, which will have been music to the ears of fossil fuel companies. Let's speak to John Hart, co-founder and vice president of C3 Solutions, or the Conservative Coalition for Climate Solutions. Good to have you with us, Mr. Hart. And have I oversimplified Mr. Trump's attitudes towards climate change?
Well, it's great to be with you. And I think you have in some respects, and I'm going to offer a more optimistic take on this debate. I think what you're going to see with the new administration is a group that's going to argue for economic freedom and bottom-up solutions. So C3 Solutions put out a report a couple years ago called Free Economies Are Clean Economies. And what we did is we did a deep dive research on every economy in the world and looked at their index of economic freedom as measured by things like low taxes, less government, efficient systems, and so on. And we did an overlay with the Yale Environmental Performance Index and showed that the free economies were twice as clean as the less free. So the Trump administration, I predict, is not going to lead with a climate change as a hoax message as much as, to the extent that CO2 emissions are a risk, then we ought to embrace policies that lead to bottom-up innovation, energy abundance. And that suite of policies will lead to the emissions reductions that I think people want to see around the world that COP is certainly going to discuss. And I think your previous guest hit on all of the same issues that are always talked about, is there's future promises, future targets, but what matters far more than future promises are today's policies. And I would reassure people that I think the Trump administration they are going to support an energy abundance agenda.
Well, but you mentioned that a couple of times. Energy abundance, that means greater use of coal, oil, fracking.
It means energy abundance means if if we know as a species that what drives innovation is more energy and cheaper energy, and it's a counterintuitive principle. So, for example, I live on a farm outside of DC. Okay, when I look out my window, I see mountains that 150 years ago they were clear cut, and a lot of the UK was clear cut. And what saved the trees during that era was something called coal. So now that we've burned coal, we've realized there are byproducts that are negative of coal. But the economic activity generated by that energy source has led to new breakthroughs, new innovations, such as nuclear, small modular nuclear reactors, cleaner ways of using fossil fuels, whether it's carbon capture, whether it's fracking. And I think what the Trump administration is going to say is there is no reverse gear in economic history. The degrowth agenda is an anti-human agenda that will lead to incredible suffering. Back at the last COP, you know, the chair famously said that if we got rid of fossil fuels today, we'd all move back into caves. And so there would be an apocalyptic scenario of moving overnight away from fossil fuels. And so again, it's and even Kerry Emanuel, very esteemed climate scientist at MIT, has said that India is going to have to burn coal for a while in order to lower CO2 emissions. Well, and that is counterintuitive, but he's correct. And when you think about Africa, you can't ask a continent to decarbonize that has never carbonized.
Okay.
And there are ways to help Africa move very quickly to a position where they can do that more efficiently. But that's really going to be the mentality of the Trump administration.
Okay. And would you expect the green transition to continue under President Trump?
Well, I think so, but I think it's going to look very differently. It's going to be described in a very different way. I think what President Trump is going to do is support an all of the above energy strategy. He is going to support far more fossil fuel use than many people on the progressive left would be comfortable with. But at the same time, he's going to lower barriers to other renewable companies. Elon Musk is a great example. You know, he's being vilified now because he supported Trump, but he obviously founded Tesla. He's not a climate change is a hoax person. He's an innovation person. So you're going to see it easier to deploy these next generation technologies. Nuclear is the break the glass solution, if you will. If you really want to lower emissions quickly, and it's a very complicated, it's, you know, easier said than done. But if you can have tech companies do a regulatory bulldozer and get those deployed, you can have great change very quickly.
Mr. Hart, we're out of time, but thanks for speaking to us. John Hart, a co-founder and vice president of C3 Solutions, or the Conservative Coalition for Climate Solutions. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. Coming up, the murder case from 15 years ago that Dutch police are trying to solve with the use of a hologram.
The hologram is actually a computer-generated visualization of Betty. And in the hologram, she reaches out to onlookers or passers-by asking for help. And at some point, you can actually see a cloud appearing with the word help in it. And she's also attracting attention from passers-by with the use of her hand.
More on that story later in this edition of NewsHour. The latest headlines, though, from the BBC newsroom: Ukraine and Russia have launched their biggest drone attacks on each other since the start of the war, nearly 3 years ago. We'll have more details on that. And the Kremlin has described the signals coming from Donald Trump on Ukraine as positive, because he's not talking about inflicting defeat on Russia. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour Live from the BBC in London. To Madagascar now, and some inspiring examples of how people are helping protect their local environment and their own livelihoods at the same time. The second largest island nation in the world lies off the coast of southern Africa, and nearly 90% of its plants and animal species can't be found anywhere else in the world. But much of their habitat is being destroyed, jeopardizing the wildlife and the food sources many of the island's nearly 30 million people rely upon. Sarah Tierish has been to meet some of those finding ways to help.
Mais il y a aussi le fait que on sait pas.
Most farmers don't know how to keep the soil fertile, so they burn whatever is left of the forest to plant on the fresh land.
This is Tanya. She created an organization that's trying to fight this problem by teaching farmers how to grow food and trees at the same time, addressing two of Madagascar's biggest problems at once, deforestation and food insecurity. Together, we're visiting a hillside just north of the capital, Antananarivo, where she and the farmers are running an experiment, turning this dead patch of land into a special kind of forest that will help feed plenty of families in this area.
So, for example, this here is an avocado tree, and around it they've grown vegetables.
Like this, the water will be stored there. Then we plant fruit trees in the hole and vegetables around it. We also plant lemongrass to stabilize it and other crops to nourish the fruit tree. The key here is to ensure the water doesn't just flow away.
This is Tanya's home. Her small orange brick house is surrounded by a lush food forest where every crop and every tree serves a purpose. And sewage from her house waters the soil. Tanya and her husband trained over 60 farmers across the region who now use these methods. In classrooms and in the field, the farmers learn all they need to know to become more resilient, growing enough food and even generating a small income without destroying the forest. The World Wildlife Fund estimates that more than $140 million is lost every year in the Southwest Indian Ocean to illegal shrimp and tuna harvesting. And there's one ethnic group in particular, the Vesu, whose survival really depends on the ocean's health. They're a tribe of nomadic fishermen, but now more and more are forced to set up their lives on a remote group of islands because that's the only place where they can still find fish. This is the biggest of a total of 9 remote islands, a simple sandbank in the midst of the ocean, without trees or fresh water. I'm here to visit Amilson and his father Gervais.
When we first arrived here generations ago, the nature here was really healthy. There were seagrass beds and coral reefs. But now so many people are fishing here that our natural world is suffering.
Gervais is the chief of this village. Normally, the Vesu take everything they can from the sea until almost nothing is left. But now some of them are using their exceptional diving skills not to fish, but to protect the ocean by monitoring fish stocks and convincing their communities to adopt more sustainable methods.
If the coral ecosystem degrades, the fish living there will flee. And that's a really scary thought. If our resources die, our Vesu culture will disappear.
Amilson and the other divers were trained by Blue Ventures, a marine conservation organization. They now work almost autonomously, diving 1 week a month and leading regular meetings with their community to discuss how to react with new local policies. Their ultimate goal? Creating the largest locally managed marine protected area in the Western Indian Ocean.
That report by Sira Tarish, and you can hear more about these projects on People Fixing the World, wherever you get your BBC podcasts. And we go now to Amsterdam, where back in 2009, a 19-year-old sex worker named Betty Jabo was found stabbed to death in the city's red light district. She'd recently given birth. Although police immediately launched a murder investigation, her killer has never been found. But Dutch police have now reopened the case, and central to this fresh bid to find her killer is a 3D computer-generated image or hologram of the murdered teenager projected from behind a window in the red light district. We contacted Eline Roovers, a spokesperson for the Amsterdam police, and she gave me more details of this hologram.
So the hologram is actually a computer-generated visualization of Betty. And in the hologram, she reaches out to onlookers or passers-by asking for help. And with the holographic representation of the victim, we used 3D techniques. And at some point, you can actually see a cloud appearing with the word help. there are loads of cold cases. Now, and her case always have had our attention, especially because of the extremely tragic circumstances about Betty's death. And that has to do with the fact that she was so young in the brutal way in which she was murdered. No police officer was able to let go of this case. So when our Amsterdam cold case team reviewed her case, they decided, OK, we really want to make a final attempt to solve this case.
And you feel that this will be a better trigger of people's memories than, say, just handing out photographs of Betty?
We hope people will feel a sort of connection to Betty and her story, and therefore also the desire to share information with us.
I mean, for most of the people passing by and seeing this hologram, they're seeing a complete stranger. But to a lot of sex workers in the red light district, they're seeing an image of somebody maybe they knew, somebody who was a friend. And maybe that's quite upsetting.
Well, the responses so far have actually been really positive. A lot of people also nowadays knew Betty and her story and are really eager to help solving this case. We would really like to emphasize, actually, the fact that it is never too late to talk. We know from research that people who commit a crime like this usually tell multiple people about what they've done, which means that we assume there are actually people that know more about her murder. And since it has been 15 years ago now, mutual relationship might have changed over time. And we think that this might now result in people to be more willing and open to talk about what they know or have heard. And also the increase of the reward might also be effective for people to come up to us and share information.
And what are you offering now as a reward?
Well, we increased the reward and now it's 30,000 euros.
Are you working on the assumption at the moment that the killer was a Dutch person or maybe somebody from abroad?
Well, when Betty was murdered, she was working as a sex worker in the red light district. The red light district is one of the busiest places in Amsterdam and also one of the most international ones. So this is why we really specifically want to reach out to people from abroad. Is there anyone who knows more? Have they perhaps visited the red light district on that very day, the February 19th, 2009? Maybe they even remember visiting Betty herself. So we really want to encourage those people to come up to us and provide us with information.
That was Alina Ruvers, spokesperson for the Amsterdam Police. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall. This is NewsHour. Do stay with us. We have a lot more to come in the next 30 minutes after a summary of the latest world news. You're with NewsHour. And the death toll from Israel's assault on Gaza, now in its second year, is approaching 46,000 people, according to Hamas, deemed a terror group by many Western governments. The UN says that in the first 6 months of the conflict, 70% of those killed were women and children. For weeks now, Israel has been engaged in a withering air and ground assault on northern Gaza, focusing on Jabalia, and 30 people, including 13 children, are reported to have been killed in the latest two airstrikes. I heard more from the BBC's John Donison in Jerusalem.
I've seen the pictures from the scene, massive destruction, people trying to get to the injured, trying to get people out from under the rubble. It does look like a pretty significant strike. At the same time, there was another strike in Sabra, which is in Gaza City, and there you had, I think, five people killed.
Is there any clarity on what Israel is now doing in northern Gaza? Because there's been a lot of talk about it implementing what's known as the General's Plan, which would involve the evacuation of all civilians from the north and the declaration of a military zone.
Well, Israel's government has denied that is the plan, but it is certainly the fear from Palestinians who see what they say is ethnic cleansing in northern Gaza to allow that part of the strip to become a closed military zone. This comes just 2 days before that US set deadline for Israel to dramatically improve humanitarian access to Gaza and also to take efforts to diminish the number of civilian casualties. Well, that does not seem to have happened, certainly to the extent the Americans want. And, you know, these sort of incidents have become normalized. But, I mean, there is a question some people will be asking, no matter who you are going after, does that justify the killing of 13 children and possibly other civilians?
Meanwhile, John, any reaction, substantial reaction in Israel to Qatar suspending its role as a mediator between Israel and Hamas in trying to secure a ceasefire in Gaza?
Not from Israel, but I think, look, this is the Americans trying to put the squeeze on Hamas to try and get a ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas in the last few weeks of Joe Biden's presidency. And, you know, both Hamas and Qatar have denied that Hamas officials are being kicked out of Qatar. And if Qatar is not going to be a key mediator, as it has been, between Hamas and Israel and US officials to try and get a ceasefire, then it does leave Hamas looking more isolated. If they were to leave Qatar, there is the question of where would they go, because they've been seen not to be safe in Iran, where Ismail Haniyeh, the Hamas political leader, was assassinated a few months ago. They're not safe in Lebanon. The only other possibility is Turkey. And of course, Turkey is a NATO member state, and there's no suggestion that the Turkish government is ready to welcome them there.
That was the BBC's John Donison in Jerusalem. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Julian Marshall. Ukraine and Russia have unleashed the biggest drone attacks against each other since the beginning of the war nearly 3 years ago. Ukraine's Air Force says Russia launched 145 drones attacking all parts of the country. It says it shot most of them down. Russia says 34 Ukrainian drones were destroyed as they approached Moscow, forcing flights to be diverted from three of the city's main airports. This heavy exchange of fire comes at a time of growing unease in Ukraine about the incoming Trump administration. I've been speaking to John Luff, Associate Fellow of the Russia and Eurasia Programme at the international think tank Chatham House in London. How does he account for this upsurge in drone activity?
I think we have to remember that the war is still going on, and each side is trying to put the other under pressure. It's clear that the Russians have significant numerical superiority on the battlefield in Donbass. They're grinding forward, but they are making really pretty slow progress, and they're taking huge losses. And the Ukrainian response has been in some ways asymmetrical. They've developed really significant drone capacity. They're now developing longer-range missiles. And they have been able to strike targets deep into Russia, including, for example, ammunition dumps on some scale. And I understand last night they hit an important ammunition storage facility in Russia. And obviously their goal is to try to disrupt as far as they can this Russian offensive.
But Russia seems to be saying we can do this as well.
Oh, most definitely. You know, the Russians understand, I think, very well that part of this is simply psychological warfare. And if they can demoralize the civilian population in Ukraine, they can hope to progressively sap the country's will to fight. Hence, the many attacks on energy infrastructure, critical infrastructure in general. But for the moment, the Ukrainians seem to be holding reasonably firm. But we can expect during the winter, this is going to be very tough. And keeping the country's morale is going to be a big challenge for President Zelensky and the government.
But this sudden upsurge in drone activity, you don't connect it in any way to the forthcoming change in the White House?
No, I think that's possibly a little too linear as a way to read it. We've seen in recent months these upsurges in drone activity, for example, on both sides. Of course, both sides are now conscious of the fact that there is going to be, you know, some intervention from Washington that may or may not determine the next phase of this war. So both have certainly an interest in trying to show that they are determined to continue fighting. And if the point were to be reached where some sort of peace process were to begin, and I say peace rather cautiously here in inverted commas, then each side wants to show that it's in a relatively strong position. So you could argue that this competition, if you like, is perhaps being influenced by the overall environment after Trump's victory, but I still think that it just reflects the general course of the war.
Can you envisage a situation where less munitions are coming from Washington and the European Union picks up the slack?
I think it's hard to see how the European Union is going to be able to compensate quickly for a reduced US commitment to Ukraine. Over time, if the European defense industry were to really start functioning properly, if the EU were able to source ammunition and weaponry from elsewhere, yes, maybe that can happen. But there could be a phase in the meantime where the Ukrainians are, once again running short of ammunition, and that will make life on the battlefield extremely hard.
That was John Luff of the international think tank Chatham House. In a desert in northeastern Africa, you'll find a country that is home to the most pyramids in the world, and it's not Egypt. It's Sudan, currently engulfed in a civil war which has so far claimed the lives of more than 60,000 people and displaced about 11 million. And that war is slowly encroaching on the pyramids of Meroe, a former capital of the ancient kingdom of Kush. Soldiers from the Rapid Support Forces, which are fighting the Sudanese army, have already stolen artefacts from the Sudan National Museum in Khartoum. The Sudanese British journalist Zainab Badawi is the author of An African History of Africa, and she's been telling me about the pyramids at Meroe.
So in total, there are about 1,000 pyramids in Sudan, and about 200 of them preserve their superstructure in some shape or form, and some are actually standing. And the ones in Meroe, which is the ancient city of Meroe, about 200 kilometres north of Khartoum, and actually it's now known as El Bajrawiya, is not to be confused with the modern city of Meroe. I mean, if you go there, you go through a long drive through the desert from Khartoum, and, dwellings are diminishing in number, and then suddenly set against these reddish brown hills, dozens of pyramids suddenly appear. Some of them don't have their pinnacle, and others are actually tipped rather incongruously, restored by concrete. And these pyramids are smaller than the ones that exist in Egypt. Early in Sudan's ancient history, in the north of the country, the dead were buried in tombs adjacent to the pyramids, but then later on they began to bury the dead inside pyramids, just like the ancient Egyptians. These pyramids, would have been full of treasures and goods for the dead to use in the afterlife, but sadly, of course, they've been desecrated and plundered over the centuries. And it's just absolutely tragic that we are witnessing this possible, mass destruction of Sudan's cultural heritage in the modern era.
You've already said that the pyramids at Meroe have already been looted. I mean, what is the threat to them if the fighting between Sudan's warring factions gets any closer?
I mean, the pyramids themselves are just, structures. So per se, they're not going to, presumably, unless somebody just wants to, wanton damage and just start, destroying them, because they don't obviously contain any jewels and treasures today. They're all kept in the museums. The real threat is to the museums, the recently renovated National Museum in Khartoum. There are other museums dotted around the Sudan, and it's the principal one in Khartoum, which houses the treasures of ancient Sudan, which has already been looted. I mean, it's heartbreaking that this has happened. There's gold jewellery like bracelets and necklaces, exquisite ceramic potteries which are enamelled, which date back thousands and thousands of years.
So you feel that the Meroe pyramids themselves are safe, but the potential threat to them is indicative of the general threat to Sudan's cultural past represented by the current civil war.
Absolutely. The fighting in Sudan has shown that there's no regard for human life. And so I do expect that there's going to be respect for ancient monuments, really, you know, why would there be, when you are confronted with such, you know, a terrible conflict, that I would just hope that these structures, that people don't just, you know, for the sake of it, just want to destroy them. I mean, I just hope that nobody will, you know, think it's worthwhile destroying these structures.
Sudanese British journalist Zainab Badawi. Derived from the martial and artistic traditions of African slaves brought to the New World by the Portuguese, the street dance of capoeira is one of Brazil's most iconic art forms. But despite this status, and many of the capoeira masters who developed the dance in the 20th century struggled to find fortune in their home country. Some left Brazil to spread capoeira overseas, while others died in poverty at home. In the former slave port of Salvador, a new generation of capoeira masters are working to ensure the legacy of those pioneers is not forgotten, as BBC's Brazil João Fellet reports.
You do 100 years of capoeira, you are a capoeirista, and you know nothing.
Nestled in the heart of Pelourinho, the historic center of Salvador, is Lua Rasta's Capoeira Museum.
There are photos of Mali. These houses here, do you see here?
Lua's museum is filled with instruments he collected as he spread capoeira around the world, from West Africa to Switzerland and Thailand. Like generations before him, he says he felt liberated by the art form.
Boy, I was too oppressed. That's what led me there to capoeira, you know?
Based on the traditional dance of those brought to Brazil in bondage, the art form has had a difficult relationship with the country of its birth. One of the grandfather of modern capoeira was Mestre Pastinha. He was born in 1889, 1 year after slavery was abolished in Brazil. The year after that, capoeira was outlawed in Brazil. By the time Pastinha died, capoeira had become emblematic of Afro-Brazilian culture around the world. Sadly, he would also die lonely and penniless.
I was very sad not to be able to help him. I wanted to have a little resource to help him.
João Grande was one of his pupils and took up his mantle as a capoeira master. Like his teacher and so many other masters, he struggled to make it pay in his native country. He tells me how he had to give up capoeira and get a job washing cars. Eventually, he would leave for New York, setting up an academy there that thrives to this day. But in Brazil, the cycle repeated, with many of its greatest names forced to emigrate for a better life.
We forgot about the people who moved, who made the culture of this country happen.
Sabiá is one of the next generation of capoeira masters.
I always saw all these masters in extremely fragile situations during the end of their life cycle. There was always a small fund to pay for burial or to give some kind of medical assistance.
This year, he organized João Grande to come home to a hero's welcome. In spite of the struggles of many of its leading lights, there is room for optimism regarding the future of capoeira in Brazil. Historically reserved for men, increasingly women are helping to ensure the art form thrives. Nani is the granddaughter of Master João Pequeno and now runs his academy.
My grandfather always said, "My daughter, capoeira is ready. It doesn't need anything. What it needs now is for you to continue." João Grande, João Pequeno,
tem tanto João nessa casa. That report by the BBC's Raul Fellet. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Donald Trump was elected president despite being a convicted felon and despite his alleged involvement in the infamous attack on the US Capitol on January the 6th. The night before that attack, Steve Bannon, a hero of the right, sent a message on his radio show, "All hell is going to break loose tomorrow." A former counselor in the Trump White House, he was sentenced to 4 months in the summer for refusing to obey a congressional subpoena to give evidence on January the 6th. Just out of prison, he's sure that the new president will commute the sentences of the hundreds jailed for their part in the riot. It's also clear that Trump's own trials will not now proceed. The BBC's James Naughtie went to see Steve Bannon. Formally, he didn't speak for President-elect Trump, but their fellow victors in a divided country. Steve Bannon first recalled the chaotic White House at the start of Mr. Trump's first term. This time, he said, they'd be ready.
Unlike last time, where we had Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan. You know, Paul Ryan was the House, Mitch McConnell, they had their kind of own ideas. This time, when you hit when you hit January 20th in the first 100 days, I think you're going to see a much more organized. Plus, you know, I just gave a speech last night at Capitol Hill. The entire House and Johnson, they all know they won because of Trump. And you're going to see the first 100 days of President Trump's second term are going to be pretty incredible.
You know what General Kelly said of Trump? He said he fitted, in his view, the general description of fascist.
Yeah, General Kelly is a guy I've known for many years and was a good man. Here's the problem. They all come from the system. General Kelly's a good man, but he didn't quite understand being part of the system of a neoliberal neocon, and he's a big proponent of the American empire. Anybody that sits there and opposes the American empire, and I spent years in the Navy. My daughter went to West Point. I want to deconstruct the American empire. Just because we want to deconstruct the American empire and stop the forever wars doesn't make us fascists. We won an overwhelming victory at the ballot box with every demographic group except, I think, for the atheists. So all the guys that opposed President Trump and called him a fascist and a dictator, all the people that sat there and go, oh, you know, this is terrible, nobody supports this, they're all proven dead wrong. We actually are more connected to the American people.
When people like General Kelly, who are concerned about Trump, you hear him saying that illegal migration is poisoning the blood of our country. Now, when you talk about poisoning the blood, that's the language of the infection brought in by the outsider. That's not normal democratic politics.
We just won. The African-American and Hispanic groups, one of their number one issues is to remove all 15 million. See, this is why you guys, and if you have the guts to put this up, I'm going to rip BBC's face off. Because the reason you're losing, and quite frankly, destroying your own countries, is you refuse to see what the reality is. This immigration wave, it's not the immigrants, it's not the illegal aliens' fault, the immigrants' fault. They're trying to come from horrific situations. I understand that. But that's not the way this system can work. And we are going to return to their home countries in a humane way and with the work of their countries, all 15 million. If you present the people in your country, the citizens in your country, with policy prescriptions that not just simply put the country first, but most importantly, put the citizen first, put the little guy, put the average guy first, that every law you pass, every executive order you pass, everything you do takes into account what's better for them, and you stop the endless wars, you stop the open borders. If we do our job correctly, we can get two-thirds. We have a total realignment.
When you talk about ending the endless wars, does that include letting Putin win in Ukraine?
We should stop all funding for Ukraine immediately. What happens on the Russian-speaking eastern border of Ukraine is what happens there. That's not central to the national security interests of the United States.
That was Steve Bannon, an ideological ally of Donald Trump. Now, it may have escaped you, but it's the Panettone World Cup. The world's best pastry chefs have gathered in Milan to vie for the title of the best traditional Panettone 2024. This Italian dessert has become very popular for the Christmas season in the past few years all around Europe. A participant is Francesco Corratella, executive pastry chef at 5 Hertford Street, an Oswald private member club in London. He joins us now from Milan. And Francesco, for the uninitiated, just explain to me, what is a panettone? Francesco? Nope. I'm afraid that Francesco Corotella, a panettone chef, appears to have dropped in the course of an attempted conversation we were having with him for the time being. We'll have to lose it. Now, parliamentary elections are taking place in Mauritius, where all candidates to lead the government have promised to tackle a cost of living crisis. The Prime Minister, Pravin Jugnauth, who came to power in 2017, says he'll raise minimum wages and increase pensions. We'll hear about that some other time, but let's head back to Francesco Corotella. And Francesco, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, what is a panettone?
What is a panettone? Panettone is a very special brioche. I would say the most special brioche in the world, which takes a lot of effort to make it. I mean, for us at Burley Bakery, it takes about 3 days of process before we end up with the final product that we sell at the shop.
And some of the best panettone chefs in the world are there in Milan, are they?
Yes, yes. There is the elite of the pastry chef specializing in panettone here in Milan. From Brazil, Japan, of course, a lot of Italian, France, Spain, Peru. And, yeah, one of the biggest representants is Brazil, because the Brazil is the biggest consumer of panettone in the world.
Goodness
talking
me.
To these guys, yes, talking to these guys yesterday, this year they sold 430 million of panettone in the whole country.
Gosh. So tell me about your own recipe for panettone. And you're clearly hoping to be the winner, are you?
Well, of course, everyone hopes for that. But like I said to another journalist just before, already being here is a big victory for me, for Vincent, my colleague, for our business, Burley Bakery, of course. You know, being with the best in the world in Milan, representing the UK, for me, I'm really proud, and I hopefully I can make UK proud as well to be here. Regarding our panettone recipe, what is the secret? I mean, the most important thing is the lievito madre, or natural yeast, or mother yeast.
Okay.
Our lievito madre is 60 years old. There are two generations of
Francesco. Francesco, yeah. I'm going to have to break in there. I'm afraid we're out of time, but I did get some sense of what makes a good panettone. That was Francesco Corotella. That's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.